From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Each week we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, a discussion about the significance of events in 2002 and how they might impact the year ahead.
It does feel like the whole infrastructure of a lot of the institutions we've watched just grow too bureaucratic, too unresponsive, too powerful. You know, the old adage about the arrogance of power really has affected the pillars of society everywhere.
A look back at 2002, tonight, on Boston University's World of Ideas. First, this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. President Bush is denouncing as despicable today's twin suicide bombings in Tel Aviv. At least 23 people were killed and more than 100 others were wounded when two Palestinians detonated explosives in a crowded downtown area. It was the bloodiest incident in the Middle East in 6 months. Within hours, Israeli helicopters fired missiles on targets in the Gaza Strip. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
The old bus station has been the scene of Palestinian attacks in the past, and witnesses today reported two explosions, one right after the other, during rush hour. Sunday marks the beginning of the Israeli work week. Witnesses reported that buildings for blocks around shook with the intensity of the explosions. Rescue personnel fought their way through traffic to get to the scene. Prime Minister Sharon's spokesman, Ranan Gissin, said that Israel was facing what he called a wave of terrorism and that Israeli forces would continue to battle armed Palestinian factions. Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat said Yasser Arafat condemned the killing of civilians. The area where the attack occurred is frequented by foreign workers, and Israeli authorities issued a special call for those in the country illegally to get medical attention, promising not to take legal action against them. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Russia is pledging to work with South Korea to help defuse the showdown between the United States and North Korea over the North's nuclear weapons program. South Korean diplomats will meet with officials in Washington and Tokyo this week in an effort to advance a plan which could include multilateral security guarantees in exchange for a cessation of nuclear arms development by Pyongyang. NPR's Lawrence Sheets has more from Moscow.
Russia is one of the few countries which enjoys cordial relations with the communist North. The normally reclusive North Korean leader Kim Jong-il has visited Russia twice during the last 18 months. South Korean Vice Foreign Minister Kim Hong-kyung said Russia had a key role to play in ending the standoff. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Georgi Mamedov says he's optimistic Moscow can use its diplomatic ties with Pyongyang to ease the crisis. North Korea's restarting of a nuclear power plant capable of producing weapons-grade plutonium does worry Russia. But Russia has also criticized what it calls emotional outbursts by the U.S. aimed at North Korea. The U.S. has refused direct talks with North Korea until it unconditionally scraps its nuclear program. Lawrence Sheets, NPR News, Moscow.
In a Texas town near the Mexican border, a half-dozen men, including two brothers, were shot to death today when a number of intruders barged into two rural houses, apparently in search of weapons or drugs. A woman who survived the attack said one of the assailants was wearing clothing with the word police on it. Authorities say there have been several incidents in the region in the past year in which police identifying themselves as police have invaded the homes of suspected drug dealers and stolen money or drugs. This is NPR News from Washington.
Good evening in Boston. I'm Gina Tempesta. The Reverend Al Sharpton says it's his duty to run for the Democratic nomination for president because he says his party has shifted too far right and is leaving blacks and other minorities behind. The black civil rights activist is in Boston this weekend. He is set to meet with political and business leaders tomorrow, including Boston Mayor Tom Menino. Franklin residents will soon be getting new details for a development which could close down a 74-year-old theater in town. A public hearing is set tomorrow that may reveal whether that theater will be demolished to make room for an apartment complex. The cost of parking at an MBTA garage or lot will be going up tomorrow. The T is doubling parking fees at some of the commuter rail stations as well as subway stations, which will be going up 50 cents. And the Native American tribe that is hoping to run the state's first casino has struggled with other businesses and is plagued by financial woes. Members of the Wampanoag tribe have lost money on a delicatessen, a general store, and a shellfish hatchery on Martha's Vineyard. Tribal leaders are admitting that they have made business mistakes in the past. It's 9:05. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the American Textile History Museum, Lowell, now featuring a new exhibit, Reflections, Fashion Dolls, and the Art of Growing Up, a mother-daughter holiday experience. Information at athm.org. By Regis College in Weston, offering graduate and an accelerated undergraduate degree program for adult working adults. 1-866-GET-REGIS or online at regiscollege.edu. And by the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation, working with partners to identify and develop pivotal opportunities in entrepreneurship and education, emkf.org. In the forecast tonight, cloudy with the chance of some light snow, lows in the mid-20s. Cloudy tomorrow with highs in the mid-30s. Cloudy and cold tomorrow night, lows once again in the 20s. Right now it's 32 degrees in Boston.
Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Tonight we're going to discuss significant events of 2002 and then look ahead to 2003. And joining us are three individuals who by profession observe, analyze, and report. From the Boston Globe, editorial page editor Renee Loth. From the Eagle Tribune newspapers, editor-in-charge William Ketter, who's also a journalism professor at Boston University. And from WBUR, news director Sam Fleming. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ted.
I'd like to begin by posing the question, was 2002 a perfect storm for institutional implosion? As we look at the various sectors of life, economic, religious, government, academic, we see all kinds of things popping up in a negative way. There have been scandals before, but never have so many institutions, it seems to me, been involved in scandals. Any comment?
It does feel like the whole rotten infrastructure of a lot of the institutions we've watched just grow too bureaucratic, too unresponsive, too powerful. You know, the old adage about the arrogance of power really has affected the pillars of society everywhere. You didn't mention the media, but I'm sure if we look there, there'll be a scandal in our own backyard as well.
That's Renee Loth, obviously. Bill?
Well, I agree. I think it was a year of reckoning. I think some of our most powerful institutions were finally brought to account for their behavior, their characteristics. And I think of one positive thing, though, about the year 2002. We started on a good note. The Patriots won the Super Bowl. We forget about that because at the closing days of 2002, they didn't get into the playoffs, unfortunately. But we did start on a positive note.
That's for sure. Sam?
Well, I think I agree. I also think a lot of these stories continue. And what's going to be most interesting now is how the messes are cleaned up and how we move forward, the Catholic Church perhaps being our best example.
Let's hold that thought and hold off an examination of that institution for the moment and begin with the economy. I think that that's the one that most directly affects all of us, and there have been a number of areas there that are worth talking about. Let's begin with the stock market itself. Now, for the third year in a row, it's been down. I think in part because of the Enron scandal, which began actually in the end of 2001, but carried over and then was followed by a cascading number of these things. What's been going on there? What has happened in corporate America over the last year especially that has come to light?
Well, I think the accounting scandals showed that a lot of companies were sort of cooking the books to make themselves look good, to play off the stock market. In other words, they were looking to make a lot of corporate and personal gain by making their companies look better than they actually were. And the the WorldCom, the Tycos, the Enrons, the M clones, you know, all of them came to be unmasked. And I think we found that, you know, we have to be a little more diligent. We in the media, by the way, have to be a little more diligent about looking at corporate America and the kind of bookkeeping and arithmetic they use. So I think just all of that, the accumulation of one wave after another of these accounting scandals led to investors losing faith in the market. And certainly the institutional investors were scared. And that's what caused, I think, the sluggishness in the market throughout.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the stock market is an institution that operates on psychology. And the psychology, all the indicators were pointing downward in terms of faith in the institution. You know, psychologists would tell you that the first step toward correcting any kind of personal or institutional flaw is acknowledgement, recognition of the problem. And the good news there is that there really was a pretty swift, you know, a spectacular collapse on the part of some of these companies, but then a pretty swift move toward corrective action. There were a lot of whistleblowers inside these companies that all at once became heroes. Time magazine named three of them as People of the Year last year. Even Governor Romney, you know, at his inaugural address, felt it necessary to acknowledge the lack of faith that people were feeling in these institutional players, religious players, corporate players, governmental players, and to sort of lay out a proposal for how he would go about correcting that.
And yet, it seems to me, Ted, that looking at the problems in corporate America, a lot of them there's a lot of corrective action that still needs to be taken, and some of it is built into the infrastructure, like a stock analyst having an interest, a self-interest in the success of a stock or that kind of thing. I think there are a lot of things that still need to be done to get investors to feel good again about perhaps getting back into the market and feeling confident about corporate leaders and confident about how the stock market even works.
Well, in fact, about $3 trillion in value was lost in that simple response. Eliot Spitzer, the Attorney General of New York, was the lead player to initially surface it, naming some of the biggest investment companies in the country and getting money from them. $100 million from Merrill Lynch. Goldman Sachs was named. CS First Boston, I believe, was also involved. So it seems to be an institution-wide thing. This surprised me. I have to admit that. I think you look for an occasional player here or somebody over here who might be involved. But this seemed to be a culture.
Exactly. The culture was the word I was just going to use. And any number of legislative fixes or regulatory fixes that are proposed will not really succeed in changing the culture because people make the culture of an institution. And so what needs to really change for enduring repair of the problem is just different attitudinal and cultural approaches to business, to politics, to government, to religion, to all of those institutional pillars.
I think the stock market problems of 2002 created a great shock to a lot of people when they discovered it was going to affect their retirement funds. And when some of these employees, their 401k funds completely disappeared, people that were retired thought they were counting on it for their life savings, suddenly it disappeared. I mean, that's the kind of legislative change which is needed to make sure that in the future, you know, we protect that kind of an investment that people make and count on. And Alan Greenspan, we didn't hear a lot about in 2002.
Although his irrational exuberance statement of 1999, someone was saying, if we'd had the crash then, we'd all be a lot healthier today. But it just went on.
I also think that in terms of the economy, that getting, you know, I've just been listening the last week about the analysts talking about where things are going to go this coming year and how things went last year. And nobody can agree on, you know, they can look at the exact same thing and not agree on it. And I think that there is a sense that that consumers have, whether it's with their 401k plan or just trying to save their money and figuring out what to do with it, or whether to stay in the stock market or get out of it, that there's a concern not only for these corporate malfeasance that happened, but also just a sense of not knowing where the economy is going to go. Getting back to what Renee said, the psychological factor right now is even the experts don't seem to have any idea about what's going to happen.
That's Sam Fleming, who's director of news for WBUR. He's joined by Bill Ketter, who is editor in charge of the Eagle Tribune Publishing Company, and Renee Loth, who is editorial editor for the Boston Globe. You started to say something.
I was just going to say what everybody knows. It's a very unsettled time right now. There is, on the world stage, nationally, people's own family finances are unstable, unsettled. All of that just contributes to the lack of investment in the stock market.
Yeah, on the world stage, of course, on the economy side, we had the euro introduced this year. And the amazing thing is that the euro is on the same equity value right now as the American dollar. I find that astounding. You know, within a 12-month period, you find equity between the euro and the American dollar. And I think, what, there are 12 countries, 12 European countries. The European Union is talking about expanding, you know, into Eastern Europe, adding 10 more countries by 2004. So, I mean, that's – we're in a global economy. We all know that. But, I mean, when the euro goes so fast that it, you know, it gains in strength and we drop in power in terms of the American dollar and they're on the same footing – that says something about the global
economies. And it's an interesting time, I think, because of that too. In my lifetime, I don't think I've ever sensed sort of the faith in America. There's always a faith about America rebounding, and I know that it still exists right now. But people are really unsure, more unsure than I think I've ever seen them.
Well, some of the factors that can happen. This is the third year in a row. I think we mentioned that the stock market lost value. That hasn't happened since 2932. And the consumer confidence is down to 80 in the latest reports. That used to be 110, 120 for years. One of the things that happened after the Great Depression was that a whole generation, not of the people who were earning at that time, but their children, stayed out of the market for 20 years. And you can actually track the only gradual growth in market values. Do you think that could happen here, or do 401ks make it impossible?
I think we've become so – the market is so controlled by institutional investors that I just don't think that's going to happen. I mean, the market at the, in 29, 32 and thereafter, you know, was just sort of gaining its legs. But I think it's the market, I think, will rebound. I think it'll come back, but it has to go through this sort of trough that it's in.
How about international investors? One of the things that propped it up for a long time was this was the only safe haven anywhere in the world. Now the euro is coming up, as you say. There's a European stock market.
There's talk about deflation. I think I heard something about it in Japan just the other day. And that's an issue that none of us know very much about other than reading an article here or there. But that's a scary thing when you hear about what it actually means.
It means falling
values,
lower prices.
I think inflation may be something we have to look at because of the cost of energy. You know, we're looking at an energy problem, and that could very well affect the cost of everything.
I think this leads into the second institution that we might want to examine. That's news out of the government. One of the difficulties that the markets had in getting reestablished was the naming of Harvey Pitt as the Securities and Exchange Commission fellow, and then he went and named William Webster to oversee the accounting board, and it turned out that neither of those fellows had completely white skirts. So government, in its deregulatory frenzy, pulled away some of the safeguards and now has folks in there that really don't know how to re-regulate. Is that what we need, re-regulation, Sam?
It sounds like we definitely need re-regulation, even just for the fact of trying to get America to have confidence again in the system. And I think the Harvey Pitt story could not have been worse in that regard, sending people the opposite way that the government had hoped people would, you know, turn back towards feeling good about the markets. And I think that the Bush administration didn't talk about the economy until really after the election, and only now have started talking about it more. And I think people are looking to government just even for almost for perhaps token to do something. Even if it's extending unemployment benefits.
Yeah, I think token is the word, though, because, you know, we have an administration in Washington that is not friendly to the idea of re-regulation and that does still, you know, play to the tune called by industry and of all kinds, especially the energy industry, you know, the oil and gas and mineral extraction, troika that really controls government policy on in energy and all of the regulatory aspects, environmental aspects related to that. I don't see any massive new re-regulation, despite what the people might want.
Oh, I agree. I don't think there'll be any change in the current deregulation attitude of the federal government. I mean, I think as long as you have a Republican Congress and a Republican president, you're going to have more emphasis on deregulation than re-regulation.
Although, in all fairness, when the Democrats did control the Senate, you didn't see, you know, any really huge moves.
No, well, Ted Kennedy was one of the biggest champions of deregulation, let us not forget, in transportation and other of the, you know, sort of public, what used to be considered public utilities, the airlines.
Hmm. All right. So government playing a role here in this institutional, if not meltdown, at least they're shaky and wavering.
Before we leave government, I think we should mention that Governor Romney took office this week, and I'm very excited about seeing what he's going to do, because I just get the sense that he's going to really shake things up, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens on Beacon Hill over the next couple of years, and especially over the next 6 months.
Well, we're going to have a new gang of three, right? We're going to have one old player in Finneran, Travellini in the Senate, and a new governor, Romney. I think it's going to be an interesting mix and match. But the fact of the matter is that Massachusetts fiscally, you know, is in the hole. And all three of them have to pull together if they're going to make some progress on this front. And I think there's a spirit of cooperation, but there's going to be questions of what to cut and how deep to cut it and where to make the change in government, how to reorganize government. That will be a big battlefield.
That's right. There was a lot of good symbolism in the governor's inaugural this past week. You know, the House and Senate members, the Speaker and the new Senate President each shared the swearing-in duties. There was a lot of talk about volunteerism. The Girl Scouts and City Year all had big roles in the inaugural. But, you know, it's about more than symbols. And so it's going to be important to see how a very hopeful and energetic new administration can translate that into action.
And, of course, Massachusetts is not alone. Budgets all over the country at the state level are in the red almost everywhere. In fact, there are those who say it's the worst fiscal crisis in the states in 60 years. But do you see help coming from the federal government? The last time this happened, help came from the federal government.
Yeah, I do think that maybe I'm being, you know, unnecessarily rosy here, but I do think this is one area where the federal government is going to step up to the plate and that there will be an increase in revenue sharing, that old-fashioned phrase we haven't heard in years.
It was a Republican president who inaugurated it, Richard Nixon.
Indeed. And, you know, the governors, including the Republican governors, are all just screaming now, saying that they've been given unfunded mandates from the federal governments, particularly around the new education reform, national education reform law, the No Child Left Behind law,
right. Mm-hmm.
That requires a lot of new standards and testing and quality teachers and lots of new requirements without sufficient funds. So I think at least around education, which is the most popular government program left, there will be some sharing of the burden there.
I think we'll get help from the federal government because keep in mind that the federal government is the only unit of government that can deficit finance. You know, the state can't, most cities can't, so they're going to need help.
That's a good point.
And they do have the authority to provide deficit financing so they can go further into debt in terms of helping others to get out of what be an economic malaise.
That's Bill Ketter. He's editor in charge of the Eagle Tribune Publishing Company. He's joined by Renee Loth, who is editorial page editor for the Boston Globe, and WBUR News Director Sam Fleming. I'm Ted O'Brien, and you're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. Before we leave the federal government, though, let's look at some of the institutions. You mentioned whistleblower Renee, who blew the whistle on the FBI, and we've all lived through this past year of the trial and conviction of John Conley and the testimony by some of his superiors who were given immunity, who said they took bribes and so on. Let's look at who's watching the watchers, the FBI. Where does this confidence come from, if we have any in it as yet?
Well, I think that that's one of the things we have to look for, and I think there were a lot of interesting congressional hearings. There were also the courtroom scenario that you just cited that we watched up here in Boston. I think the FBI, the CIA, all of those institutions, and especially in light of the new organization of the federal government that was just formed on Homeland Security, it's going to be interesting to see how that works. And I think it's going to take 6 months or a year just to keep a watch on it to see how it works. And especially if we get into a conflict, how is that going to be involved? You know, how is the former governor of Pennsylvania going to do leading that organization, which is huge. And just hearing about having 12 cultures try to merge into one, it's you know, the federal government hasn't done that well in that scenario in the past.
It appears to me to be some abduction of responsibility by the Congress on the part of looking over these agencies. And I think of the 9/11 problems, you know. How did we get ourselves into a point where we were so vulnerable on 9/11? Of course, we wrung our hands and we looked here and there. But there was no one was held accountable for what happened in 9/11. And, you know, I think the Congress was the place that people looked for someone to say, okay, here's the problem, here's the system, you know, how are you going to fix it? And we haven't had that. And I think that's one of the problems that we're facing as we go forward into 2003.
And when you talk about confidence in government, the president set up a commission to investigate 9/11 and put in charge of it Henry Kissinger, who was a singularly bad choice for that position, a position where you want somebody who's going to be independent of the interests on Capitol Hill. And, you know, he exited stage left. But I think that it's going to take a lot from the new directors of that commission to restore public confidence before they even go about beginning to investigate.
Well, and so didn't George Mitchell leave shortly after he was named for reasons of conflict of interest, or he simply didn't want to resign all his other things. So it's been hard to find people who would fearlessly examine it. And you make a good point, Bill. It may be that a sense on the part of the people that the loyal opposition was not reaching out cost them in the November election. What do you make of the...
I think we've lost our political spine. I mean, I think Democrats, you used to count on them to stand up and, you know, to say, fight for this. This is what we believe in. You know, this is our ideology. Now we have all the blending in the middle, and we have people don't even know who are you, Republican or Democrat? What's the difference these days?
That's really true on the state level also. You know, the differences between Mitt Romney and Shannon O'Brien were sometimes very hard to divine in the gubernatorial election up here. And, you know, the politicians are all taking polls constantly, and they seem to feel that the voters are signaling that they don't like partisanship and they don't like the sort of nasty polarization of our politics. And yet, I think they've misinterpreted that as a call for blandness in the middle, and that's not really, I don't think, what the people need.
I mean, going back to Pelosi's election to lead the Democratic the House minority down in Washington, and there was so much controversy about her being too liberal to lead that group, and yet you think about Tip O'Neill, who even when he was losing vote after vote during the initial stages of the Reagan administration, still stood up for what he believed in and never, you know, never gave into that.
Yeah. It astounded me that there were questions over her liberal, that she was too liberal to lead. And I think that was one of the problems the Democrats had in the last election. They didn't have a position. They didn't have a firm place that they were in the political spectrum.
You know, speaking of Pelosi, reminds me of something I would be remiss if I didn't add, which is that all of the politicians, left and right, in this country are so completely enthralled to the system of campaign finance that has an effect of sort of blurring the differences among them. And Nancy Pelosi, you know, I'm very excited as a woman to have another woman in that position of high power, but she's the most popular Democrat now because she is the biggest fundraiser for the party. And she's, you know, the way that she proved her bona fides was in being able to, you know, raise the money as good as the boys. And I really, you know, don't know that that is something that we should be celebrating.
Well, again, if you have the feeling that Congress is speaking with one voice, even in Mitt Romney's inaugural address, he said Republicans have in the time past believed that the corporate private sector was the answer. Democrats have believed that government was the answer. I fall somewhere in between, which, you know, gives him a very large umbrella. But before we leave Congress, and I don't think we've given it a particularly high mark, let's go once more over the Trent Lott thing, not because we don't all know that what he said was outrageous and should never have been said, but because it revealed what was, for many years, the Democrats' dirty little secret, which is if the solid South stays with us, then we'll ignore all the civil rights on the minorities. And now it appears, I don't know, I'm asking, that this might be the Republican secret.
It's not much of a secret. You know, the Republican strategists who put together the Southern strategy that took the South away from the Democrats and which has succeeded in, I don't know, I think there's like two or something Democratic presidents who have been from anywhere outside of the South in, I don't know, since Kennedy or something. I can't remember the exact statistic, but it's pretty striking. So I don't think it's much of a secret that, you know, that this is a pact that the Republican Party has made with the you know segregationists in the South or whatever you would call the modern versions of them today. But you know the North is not blameless in this either, and I think it's important to remember that some of the most segregated parts of the country are in our northern cities, and you know economically and racially as well.
Well, I agree. I think that it's a national problem. It's not necessarily a Southern problem. But I do think that the Republicans have been smarter politically in organizing their base in the South than the Democrats have. If you look at the raw numbers in the South, it should be Democrat no matter what. But the Democrats haven't done a very good job of recruiting the kind of party soldiers that they need, you know, to retake the South.
One more thing about Trent Lott.
Yeah.
I think the most surprising thing is that he was surprised by the reaction, and which made me believe that things like that are probably said all the time, or at least used to be, but there weren't cameras around to capture it, so it didn't have the life that this took on. You know, you hear things said privately at parties. My parents lived in the South for 10 years, and I'm shocked by the things I hear that their friends say down there.
Yeah, and I would think it would be a mistake also to assume naively that because Trent Lott is gone that the problem is gone. You know, and racism is something that this country is going to be grappling with for another generation at least. And Bill Frist, who is, you know, the new moderate, you know, hero of the South, has this virtually identical voting record to Trent Lott. So, you know, I don't think that this one, you know, unfortunate symbol of the Old South's disappearance is going to change the situation deeply.
Do you think had the conservative wing of the Republican Party thought that Trent Lott was doing enough for their program, that he would have been driven out anyway?
Well, I think the Bush administration and President Bush particularly had just decided that he had to go. And once that happened, nothing was going to save him.
All right. What about the freedom of speech during the year 2002? I am old enough to be shocked that John Poindexter would be put in charge of Total Information Awareness, some kind of computerized program that will put all this information about everybody into one grand machine and then scan it for possible terrorists. Poindexter, of course, was convicted on a number of charges, his conviction later reversed in the whole Iran-Contra scheme because he was promised immunity to testify. He's a retired admiral who went down a rank before he retired. Anybody else?
Nothing new about this. Government always wants to control information, you know, and they'll do it whatever way they can. And, of course, they'll use whatever conditions or whatever national atmosphere is at play, you know, to try to get more control over information. I think after 9/11, you know, the nation was beginning to say, hey, maybe we're too open. And the USA Patriot Act was passed, which, believe me, if you look at the language of the USA Patriot Act, you're going to find lots of loss of freedom of information, freedom of access, freedom of knowing what your government's doing because it's all now veiled. Well, it's against terrorism. Therefore, it's good to keep it quiet. It's good to keep it secret. Government should always be open. That's supposed to be the principle of American government.
Yeah. The tension between freedom and security is something that we see every day. Every time you walk through a metal detector, every time the whole question of gun control is a debate between freedom and security. The, you know, with sometimes liberals and conservatives falling on opposite sides of that line. It's a very interesting debate. And it's always inflamed in times of national peril. And that's what's happening right now. And it's just as in World War II, some American citizens were interred in, you know, prison camps, essentially. So, too, the rights of individual Americans, citizens, residents, immigrants are under fire now. And I think it's really important for us in the media, particularly because we so depend on open government to uphold the role that we have in the Constitution, that we speak out on that whenever it's possible.
Yeah, and I would just point out that our role in that, in the scheme of things, is on behalf of the people. I mean, that's what the purpose of the press is, to serve as a surrogate for the people on these matters of freedom of information, access to government records.
Well, we certainly have a lot of sources of information, but they seem to be owned by relatively few hands. Deregulation has also meant 1,000 radio station chains, television station networks.
I know one of my favorite stories I saw this week, Ted, was it was on the front page of the New York Times a couple of days ago that the Democrats are looking for a liberal spokesman to go against Rush Limbaugh because they feel like maybe that's a way to get back into the to the mainstream thought. I just found that just extraordinary.
They need a counter network to Fox.
Well, we're looking at let's take Fox. Roger Ailes makes no bones about it, was consulting the president during 9/11. ABC, owned by the Disney people, at one time Capital Cities, which is a broadcasting company, owned them. CBS used to be the Tiffany Network. Bill Paley, I don't really know who owns that, but General Electric owns NBC, and we have a continual splintering.
It's only going to get worse, Ted. When the FCC revokes the cross-ownership rule, which now prevents, you know, newspapers from owning major television stations in the same market, you're going to have even more concentration of media.
Yeah, and yet there is a duality. You know, there's the opposite trend is happening with the Internet. And I think that part of the audience and appetite for the Internet is a reaction to the corporatization of the media, of the so-called traditional media. You know, I have a love-hate relationship with the Internet because I think it's a great democratizing, tool to try to open up debate, and you know you can get information from all over the world very easily now. But there's also so much junk on the internet, and so much completely uninformed chatter, and you know that it's difficult to know sometimes where the truth lies. So
the internet, by the way, is the thing that brought down Trent Lott.
That's right. It was a weblog.
Right. The mainstream media didn't move this story until it started moving on the web. Then they caught it. Notice of it, and suddenly he's gone.
But it does, getting back to your point about media ownership, I think when you sit back and look at how some stories, it might even be the public relations campaign around a movie or a new Bruce Springsteen album, that the ownership of these companies where they own books and movies and the Today Show and a television network, and they can orchestrate things in ways that nobody can really keep track of it, even those of us whose job it is to keep track of it.
Well, that's right. I mean, we're all here involved in all of our careers, gathering information, trying to present it as neutrally as possible. And I remember when newspapers had to sell the television station if they wanted to keep the paper or sell the paper. I mean, the idea was under the Communications Act of 1934, you could have 7 licenses, and they expanded that to 7 FM licenses and AM licenses and television licenses. Now it's totally gone by the board. And I think the
Clear
result...
Channel will eventually own all of them.
Well, a lot of this, of course, is economic.
Not BUR, though.
I mean, the cost of operating an independent news organization, you know, in today's marketplace is very difficult. And so, I mean, a lot of this is driven by the need for a larger organization to, you know, provide, frankly, the resources to maintain what can be maintained.
There will be a backlash to that, though. I mean, you know, you hear a lot about Napster and the, you know, file sharing of music on the Internet again. That is a reaction to there being, you know, essentially one playlist that all pop radio stations play and that you cannot even hear. The Internet is like the new radio. It's the place where you go to get to hear new information and new music and in a kind of unregulated way and free and open and democratic way that the traditional media no longer provides.
You raise an interesting point with that, though, and that is that if there's a traditional media playlist and nothing else gets on, if you, by extension, go to news events that way or what might be important in one part of the world and that we really ought to know about here, the fact that there is such a small handful of ownership argues against news that they think might, A, upset, cost them something.
Affect the market.
Yeah. Not pleasant. Mm, we're talking about the events of 2002 and what they might foretell for 2003 with Sam Fleming, WBUR news director, Bill Ketter, who is editor in charge of the Eagle Tribune newspapers, and Renee Loth, who is the editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. I'm Ted O'Brien, and you're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. Let's look now at one of what had been for, centuries, one of the moral beacons in American life, and that would be the Catholic Church. In the past year, your newspaper, the Boston Globe, by surfacing what appeared to have been a policy of moving sexual abusive priests from parish to parish, has really opened up an entire reexamination across the country. And I'm still trying to figure out what psychological impact that might have. I mean, this is a nation. The largest single religious group is the Catholics. And here in Boston, overwhelmingly Catholic. So if we want to examine that a little bit, maybe you could begin by telling us what was it that prompted the initial investigation and that much as pulling a single thread unravels a sweater resulted in what we're seeing today.
That's right. Well, the part of the reason that the story, I think, had so much power and was so immediately affecting to particularly the Catholic community in Boston was that it was based so much on documents. You know, we had, through a court order that we filed, that the Boston Globe filed, to open up the documents around the John Gagan sex abuse lawsuit, had just a mother load of documents in these priests and other Catholic officials' own handwritings that displayed this, not just the sexual abuse, which of course is a horrendous crime, but the whole culture of secrecy and cover-up that attended the abuse, and which I think in some ways enraged people even more than the awful crime. That the crimes were committed, of course, is a terrible thing, but to compound that with a kind of arrogance again of authority and shifting people around from place to place to further abuse more children, I think was just the really contributed to the disgust that people felt with the story.
Well, now, those of us who were here in 1982 remember the Father Porter case. Mm-hmm. Right out of Fall River. What was the difference between this one and that one? Access
Father
to information?
Father Porter, Father Hanlon, there were a whole series of them about that time.
But was 92. It access to information? Yes. Was it access to information in this case?
I think that was the primary difference. I mean, there probably is some sort of cultural tipping point that we reached in 2002 that I haven't really had a chance to examine thoroughly exactly what else there was happening in the culture, what makes the culture ready to face something that we've known about for a while from time to time, but to face it so thoroughly. But I think it was primarily the just the irrefutable documentation that we uncovered that made the difference.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I don't think that, you know, previously when these stories about child molestation among priests or abuse, whatever, there was never any real documentation, and so they kind of went away. But in this case, with the Globe asking for the actual affidavits and other documents that were filed in the Gagan case, they got access to what the cardinal was saying, what his lieutenants were saying. They had it in their words, in their writing, with their signatures. I mean, that unveiled, unmasked the culture of secrecy that Renee talks about. And beyond that, that the church had an attitude that it was above the civil law, that they took care of it alone. They didn't tell the civil authorities when there were illegal criminal activity going on. I think the Globe deserves a lot of credit for aggressively pursuing this story. It was one of the major stories in the United States this year and probably in some regards the world. Mm. But there's another hero here. There's a hero of a judge, and a Judge Sweeney.
I'm
Judge
with you.
Constance Sweeney. She is the Judge Sirica of the sex abuse scandal in the Catholic Church. Sirica was the judge who made the key decisions in the Watergate case. Sweeney made the case to give the records to the Boston Globe. A lot of judges in this state, I believe, would not have made that decision.
Well, and in past haven't. What was it about this particular instance that she did not make new law, but she did go away from the customary protection when parties agreed not to release
she
or
She said
open.
There was a public interest and concern in those records, which was the legal case that the Globe was making, and said they are something that you have a right to look at.
And she did it over and over again. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't just once. I think, you know, and the pressure kept building probably for her to made it easier for her not to take that stand. And so I think for her to do that and to continue to do that in the face of the Catholic Church was amazing.
Yeah. There are some small pieces of good news that come out of this scandal that I thought I wanted to just mention. And, of course, Justice Sweeney's independence being part of that. But the reengaged voice of the Catholic laity and of certain clergy who for many years had themselves felt oppressed by the hierarchy of silence and even corruption, you could call it, in the Catholic Church, have been able to now step out. And I think that will be an enduring change in the institution, in the American Catholic Church at least. And it'll be really a wonderful story to follow how that creates institutional change.
Well, the other thing that's utterly changed is the sense of isolation that each victim felt. Mm-hmm. I have to believe that over the years, each particular case was brought by someone who had a complaint but who felt this was an utter aberration. This person was unique in the history of the last 1,000 years. What happened to me was totally, you know, against everything we know, and therefore we're going to handle it quietly and privately, and why damage the church? Because this is the only individual involved. Now we're aware that it was a policy, that it was movement was a policy, and that they had set it up and were handling it that way. And the most recent thing is that California, state of California, in an unprecedented decision, has suspended the statute of limitations for 1 year for sex abuse cases, all sex abuse cases. But initially, some 300 or 400 cases are waiting to be filed against the Catholic Church out there as a result of this, directly as a result.
Well, it's a direct threat, of course, to the financial future of the Church. I mean, somehow there has to be resolved to this because, I mean, when you get this kind of, you know, of 700,000, 5,000 lawsuits coming against the Church, any of which could result in multi-million-dollar settlements, where is the Church going to get the resources, financial resources to pay? Sure, in Boston they might be able to sell some things off. I do like the attitude of the interim administrator of the Archdiocese, Bishop Leonard, who's talked about trying to settle this thing here, even if he has to sell some Church property, to bring finality to it so they can move ahead.
All right, so as we survey 2002, have we overlooked anything that was a major news story? Were there some positive major news stories?
Well, I'll get into one more one of concern, which I think kind of slipped through the cracks because the announcements were made every Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock, and these were issues related to clean air and environmental regulation and the deregulation of environmental laws that have been in place for the last 30 years. And it's hard to know how far that's going to go, but certainly the potential ramifications are huge for our region.
This is something that I just I'm very happy that you brought it up, and I just wonder about the voters, because in survey after survey, they say they care about the environment. They're unhappy with the Republican, particularly in Washington, move toward deregulation, further deregulation of the regulatory protective framework for the environment. And yet, you know, it doesn't seem to be quite enough to change their voting habits. Maybe the, you know, terrorism and the threat of war trumps everything. But you just have to wonder about that disconnect.
Renee Love, editorial director of the, or rather editorial editor of the editorial page for the Boston Globe. Bill Ketter, who is the editor-in-chief of the Eagle Tribune newspapers, and Sam Fleming, WBUR's news director, all joining me to talk about 2002 and then 2003. I'm Ted O'Brien, and this is Boston University's World of Ideas. We almost overlooked the possibility of war here. Let's go back. Let's go back to something that Andrew Card was supposed to have said, which is what?
That you don't roll out a new product
right
before in August. What was it?
Something about that. Do you think the Iraqi threat is as the government presents it?
I don't know. I think it's tough to decide that. I mean, we've got inspectors in there now, and we'll find out. But I do think we're going to war with them one way or the other. I mean, I think Bush is determined to take on Iraq, and we may end up at war with North Korea, too. 2003 could be a war year.
Mm-hmm. I do also sense, though, that there still is internal debate within the Bush administration about the timing and how to go about it, and that Colin Powell and Donald Rumsfeld are still perhaps trying to get President Bush's ear, and a lot of the debate you sense is still going on.
Well, I think that's true. But this uncertainty, of course, is all part of the economic sluggishness, too. It causes this kind of thing. People don't know where we're headed. I think we've got to have some clarification. I personally think that the administration wants to go to war. They feel that it's going to help the economy somehow, or they're going to get even for Saddam Hussein's, getting away last time and so on. But I just think that, when all the inspections are over, because there's always a way you can find that the inspections didn't live up to what you said they were should have been doing, what the Iraqis should have been doing. There's enough muddleness in that part of the world that you can go to war if you want to.
Yeah, I think that the internal debate in Washington is really more about tactics than it is about the overarching issue of taking out Saddam. And everybody agrees that regime change is the policy of the Bush administration. The question is only whether we do it alone, we do it with the help of the United Nations, we do it in a sort of multilateral, rational step-by-step process, or whether we do it preemptively. That's where the debate has been. And
pretty important debate, though.
Yeah,
so
not to minimize
the
debate. Yes.
Yeah, and you sense that. For instance, Mr. Powell is saying we really have to have a consensus, that we have to have our European allies on board with us, that we need to go about this the right way. Well, there's another part of the administration who just can't wait to get going. And I think many of the concerns and stories that we'll end up writing about and broadcasting will not just be the event itself, which may not last that long, but will be the years afterwards, or at least the aftermath of such an event, because of the all the people that and countries that it will be impacted by it.
I think some of these terrorist groups, a lot of them are big, some of them are small. We really don't have a real good focus on how large or small they are, but I think they're out there going to be encouraging war, not only in between the United States, Iraq, North Korea, but in the Middle East. I mean, they want to bring this all into one big inferno.
Yeah, I think in some ways it plays into the hands of those who want to create a clash of civilizations, as we always hear. I don't think very many people would dispute that Saddam Hussein is a bad guy and that getting rid of him would be a liberation for his people. But I think there is some classic, military, even the generals were a little skeptical about a particular kind of military campaign in Iraq, because there are certain truisms that are not being observed here. And one really important one is that you should not go into a military adventure without an end game. And it's not clear to me or to many other, even much smarter people than I, what is the end game? You know, what do we foresee as being the replacement for Saddam Hussein? And how long are we going to have to occupy the place? And how much is it going to cost? And when do we declare victory and get out? Mm-hmm.
How convinced are you that the Iraqis are hiding weapons of mass destruction? We keep hearing from Kofi Annan, now is not the time. We have a system here that needs to be played out. We're waiting for the UN weapons inspector's final report. We should wait for that. How convinced are you that?
Well, I think this guy, Blix, who's the chief inspector, gave us some insight into the fact that he thinks there are problems over there, that they are not telling the truth completely on their biological and chemical and even some of their nuclear capability. So I think there's something there. I don't know how much of it is, what the extent of it is and so forth. We have to wait for that final report. But Saddam is a wily, clever, evil guy, I think, and there's probably things going on there.
What's interesting, though, is when you listen to others who say there are other wily, clever, evil people around the world, and, they may be in North Korea or they may be in other places. Should this be the only place that we're concerned about?
Their wily, evil, clever people took a look at what happened to the Taliban in Afghanistan, and I have to believe they're being even more wily and clever and keeping a low profile, which leads to North Korea, which was suddenly front and center, and though I have no experience personally except a couple of visits of Asia, the whole idea of face is critical to many Asian peoples. Why isn't the administration talking to North Korea, which apparently is what they want?
Yeah, this is something I just don't understand. I mean, and this is something that Colin Powell was sort of yanked back from a policy of engagement at the very beginning of the Bush administration, I think maybe even before 9/11. Colin Powell in an early
discussion was kind of a power struggle, is what I was trying to say, lost
briefly. His stand, which was that we should be engaged with North Korea and not that they were part of the axis of evil. And I think that, you know, they're a strange and closed and, you know, communist country. And, you know, they don't act by the same rules as the, you know, somewhat more Western nations do. But it seems clear that what they want is a policy of engagement, of non-aggression. And for us to be rattling our sabers at them, I just think makes no sense at all.
I find it interesting that the North Koreans apparently are playing into sort of an anti-American sentiment in the south part of Korea. I mean, we've always been the protector of South Korea. We fought a war for them, and we're there. And now, of course, they're playing off that anti-American sentiment, saying, you know, your friends down there in South Korea are not necessarily with you on this one. You know, we're trying to get the Koreas together.
And also that the United States is distracted and that it may be a good time to play this hand out.
Well, and interestingly enough, it also argues that there's an entire generation or two or maybe three in South Korea that has no memory of what North Korea was like with the Chinese back 50, 60 years ago.
Opportunity.
One of the things I find interesting, Ted, that kind of ties a lot of this stuff together is the Bush administration has been given a lot of credit for what they call its political discipline. You know, Karl Rove keeping the president on message and being so successful in the election and that kind of thing, perhaps in direct contrast to what the Democrats were able to do in the same regard. And yet, in terms of foreign policy, we're trying to figure out what its message is. And so I think the Bush administration is definitely an interesting thing to watch. It's successful, obviously, in some ways, and in terms of the November election, you can't ignore that. But I think there are a lot of people who are confused still by what their goals are in many regards, especially in terms of foreign policy.
One person who may try to exploit that confusion is our own Kerry, Senator John Kerry, who's announced that he's exploring the possibilities of running for president. I don't think there's any doubt he'd like to run for president. And if he can muster enough support, political, and, of course, I don't think the money is going to be a problem. We'll see a lot of him in 2003, and he'll be the one trying to frame the questions on both domestic and foreign policy for the Bush administration.
Along with Senator John Edwards of North Carolina and Joe Lieberman from Connecticut.
And Howard Dean, the Vermont governor, let us not forget him.
We'll keep an eye on all of them, and we'll keep an eye on all of these issues that you've so kindly raised for 2002. Well, before you all go, final thoughts on the discussion that we've had.
Thinking of some encouraging things that happened in 2002, of course, Jimmy Carter got the Nobel Peace Prize, which I think was a pretty well-deserved honor, given everything he's done, you know, to promote world peace. They had that minor story. When was that? In this summer?
This past year.
I mean, here we had people rescued. You know, I mean, this was a good news story, one that I think papers – I mean, we in the media, I know, get very self-conscious that we're playing bad news too big all the time. Can't we get a good story we can play? And that was a good story, and we played it big.
And it would be nice to think, Ted, that we'll be back in these chairs a year from now and feel good about some of the stories that have come forth over the next year.
As always, it's always the individual stories that are the good news stories, the people who surprise us with the heroism, small kinds of ways. And I think we'll probably see more of those. And we just have to hope that the media has got its eyes open to see them.
I want to thank you all for joining me.
Thank you, Ted.
Thanks, Ted.
Lots of fun. Thank you.
Our guests have been WBUR News Director Sam Fleming, Eagle Publishing Editor-in-Charge William Ketter, and Boston Globe Editorial Page Editor Renee Law. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15 each and include shipping and handling. To learn more about Boston University's World of Ideas, visit our website at buwi.org. Tonight's program is produced by Keith Infantino with help from Andy Farnsworth and John Hoder. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Johnson Drugs in Waltham, a health and wellness pharmacy offering an integration of mainstream and complementary medicine with an extensive selection of nutritional supplements, herbal medicines, and homeopathic remedies. And by North Hill, a Greater Boston Life Care retirement community in Needham, offering independent living apartments, home health, skilled nursing, and rehabilitation for 18 years. 781-433-6520. This is WBUR. It's 9:59.
I'm Bill Marks, WBUR's theater critic and editor of Arts Online. Join me this Tuesday at the Merrimack Repertory Theater in Lowell for a special performance of Old Wicked Song.